So, if you've been paying attention to your junk mail folder, you may have thought that perhaps everyone who works in high tech has gone to a writing workshop about how to write opt-in emails, and that every day you're getting dozens and dozens of emails asking, explaining privacy policies to you. And of course, the reason for this is that on May the 25th, the European Union General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, comes into effect. And it has some extremely stringent rules about how your private data needs to be managed, what rights you have to that private data, what right you have to take it with you, and rights about how things have to be communicated to you in plain language and with the ability to opt out of different kinds of collection without having to walk away from a service that you're using and so on. This has all come about fundamentally because of Germans who are haunted by the memory of the Stasi, of the former East Germany and its security state, and who have pushed through the European Union this really exemplary set of privacy rules. And Germany has become a kind of net exporter of privacy to the rest of the world as a consequence of it. And this is one of the interesting things that happens with consumer policies, with policies that are beneficial in some ways, is that you can sometimes get a race to the top. You know, California is a net exporter of auto safety rules to the rest of the world. If you want to sell in those big markets like California, you have to adhere to California's very stringent rules, and so everyone benefits as a result. Exporting tech policy is not always a great thing. Sometimes firms or nations export very bad policies. Canada is a net importer of bad internet policies from America on the whole. So one American policy I want to talk about today in particular is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, of 1998. It's kind of a big, gnarly, opaque hairball of copyright and para-copyright and internet law that was passed without a lot of debate or scrutiny in the Clinton years. The way that most of us are familiar with the DMCA is we may know the DMCA as the author of all of our favorite videos and the entity that has ordered those videos removed from the internet. This video was removed thanks to a claim under DMCA. That's Section 512 of the DMCA. The section that I want to talk about today is Section 1201 of the DMCA. This is what's called the anti-circumvention rule. And what it says is if there is an access control that stops a user of a technology from accessing a copyrighted work, then tampering with that access control is an offense. And not just a small offense, a kind of like radioactively illegal offense. So, helping someone bypass a copyright lock, a copyright access control, sometimes called a digital rights management system. Under this statute, it's a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine. And when it was passed in 1998, the primary use of this, what was then a very obscure provision, was to prop up a couple of odd corners of the technology industry, in particular the manufacture of DVD players and games consoles. So, prior to DVD players, because of standards fragmentation, people who sold pre-recorded movies had a natural way to segment their markets around the world, because in North America, we used NTSC, which stood for Never Twice the Same Color, and in the rest of the world, they used PAL. And so if you wanted to release something earlier to Europe and later to America or vice versa, you would just choose which format you release it in. And it didn't matter if someone went to London on holidays, they couldn't bring home a VHS cassette or a Betamax cassette because they didn't have the player to play it back on and they didn't have the TV to play it back on. But of course, a DVD player is just a computer with an optical drive. And it can decide what output it wants to output just by, you know, modulating the stuff differently. It's not, these aren't hardwired, soldered crystals on a board. This is just some software, right? And so that natural market segmentation became much harder to maintain. And so the companies that licensed films for DVDs, they came up with a plan. What they said is that they would have a mandate that anyone who designed a DVD player would have to check to see whether the DVD player was manufactured or sold in the same country as the DVD it was being asked to play. And if it wasn't, it would refuse to play it. And so the way that they would keep other people from just coming along and making a tool that changed your DVD player so that you could watch DVDs no matter where they were sold is by making it illegal to bypass that access control. And we also had companies like Sega that were making early consoles like the Dreamcast. And before, you know, the Dreamcast and that generation of consoles, the way that you got games was on these weird proprietary cartridges. And there was a kind of natural barrier to entry, right? If Nintendo wanted to collect a little bit of rent from everybody who ever made a video game, the way that they do that is they'd say, you got to pay us to make your cartridges. And that way we get paid no matter whether or not you sell a game. We get the manufacturing royalty for making it. But once games became CD-based, well, they were like being pressed on commodity presses that you could source from hundreds and thousands of companies around the world. And it became harder for a company like Sega to be a rent seeker, to like sit in the middle of a market contributing nothing to it, but just collecting a royalty from everyone who made a thing that sold it to a customer of theirs. So what they did was they designed a system that would check to see whether there was a little bit or checksum on the disc that said, I was officially pressed on a Sega press. And if it didn't detect that bit, it would just refuse to play the game. And since bypassing that control was a felony under the statute, everybody had to do this. Now, it's important to note that although the C in DMCA stands for copyright, like buying a movie in one country and watching it in another, that's not a copyright violation, right? That's the like literal, non-figurative, non-hyperbolic opposite of copyright infringement. To walk into a store on the high street in London or Mumbai or Mexico City and ask the rights holder's representative how many pounds sterling or pesos or rupees they want for the licensed authorized disc, and then handing that much money to them, and then bringing that disc to another country and watching it, is the opposite of copyright infringement. That is paying a rights holder the named price for a work and then using it, right? And by the same token, if I write a Sega game and I sell it to you and you play it on a computer that you own, that is the literal opposite of copyright infringement. That is me, a rights holder, making a creative work that you buy from me and watch and use. But this interferes with the business model. And so what the DMCA became is a kind of felony contempt of business model, right? It became a way for firms to assert that their commercial preferences would become a matter of law. And because breaking out of these systems was so radioactively illegal, they became stable business models. Now, that was the case in the US in 1998. Canada didn't have a law like this on the books, although the US Trade Representative spent a lot of time pressurizing various Canadian governments. And then in 2012, we got Bill C-11, thanks to Tony Clement and Moore. Gosh, what was his name? I just blanked his name. From Coquitlam, BC. Tory minister. It'll come to me. It was Clement Moore. So Clement Moore, they followed on their liberal predecessors who had previously introduced versions of this bill by holding no consultations with Canadians on it and only seeking comment from the US trade representatives and American media companies. And they passed this bill in 2012. Now, like, it's one thing to be kind of dumb about the internet and not really realize that the internet would someday grow to be important in 1998. It's kind of short-sighted, but like, you could see how in 1998 that might have seemed like at least a plausible or, you know, colorable proposition. But if in 2012 you have still not recognized that making dumb policy about the internet has far-reaching implications, you're just not paying attention. That's like felony dumb. And it was a national embarrassment that Canada passed this bill that had already manifested all of its terrible problems south of the border in 2012. So every business has a mix of commercial preferences and legal rights. Sega has the legal right to do things like stop you from cloning its patented chips and selling them, passing them off as Sega chips. But it also has this preference that everyone who bought a game would have to tip Sega for the game. And what the law does, what anti-circumvention law does, is it allows the conversion of a preference to a right. It allows a firm to effectively impose on its customers the duty to arrange their affairs to benefit the firm's shareholders at their own expense. And this is effectively a license to print money, right? What CEO has not gone to bed, you know, anxious about the next quarterly report and thought, if only it were a felony and a jailable offense to thwart my commercial plans in the marketplace? And so once felony contempt of business model became a legal reality, at least in these limited domains of DVD players and Dreamcasts, other firms decided to go and have a poke at it and see if they could make it work for them. And so around 2002, 2003, a couple of hardware vendors took a swing at this. One was this company, Skylink. They made garage door openers, and they made garage door opener remotes. Like a lot of companies that make consumables or parts for their original equipment, they charge a lot of money for replacement remotes. So, you know, a garage door remote is the kind of thing you lose or need an extra one of, or accidentally leave on the roof of your car and then back over. And so they had a kind of thriving business charging shocking amounts of money for a commodity piece of electronics. And their customers figured out, their competitors figured out that they could manufacture a third-party remote and sell it for less than Skylink was, and that they could then take some of Skylink's business and put it in their own pocket and benefit Skylink owners by selling them a lower-cost remote. And they went to court over it, and the court didn't buy it. And the court said, like, this is supposed to protect... the statute says that it stops people from bypassing access controls for copyrighted works. And this is just a garage door opener. It's not copyrighted, right? It's a bunch of four-way linkages and like actuators and solenoids. Show me the copyrighted work in this. There's no poem inscribed on the inside of your device. And so they lost, right? And then these guys had to swing Lexmark, which was then the printer division of IBM. They made laser toner cartridges, and laser toner cartridges are also made out of something, are filled with something non-copyrightable. They're filled with carbon. Carbon is a decidedly non-copyrightable element, right? And it's also cheap. We actually have a problem getting rid of carbon. It's not that we have any kind of shortage of carbon. And so under normal circumstances, you would expect powdered carbon to be cheap. But Lexmark had this idea that their shareholders would benefit if you paid more for carbon than you would pay for Veuve Clicquot. And so they added a microcontroller to their cartridges. Now this was 2002, and microcontrollers were expensive then relative to now. And so their microcontroller, it only had 12 bytes of headroom. So they could put one 12-byte program in it. It only did one thing. When the cartridge ran out of toner, it said, I'm an empty cartridge. And then if you put more carbon in the cartridge and put it back in the machine would say, are you a full cartridge? And it would say, no, I'm an empty cartridge. And then it wouldn't print. So Static Controls was a competitor of theirs. They reverse engineered the program. It wasn't hard. The program was 12 bytes long. And they wrote a new program that said, I'm a full cartridge, right? And so Lexmark sued them. And the judge said again, show me your copyrighted work. And Lexmark said, software is copyrightable. And we have a 12-byte program in there. That's our copyrighted work, right? It's like War and Peace, but shorter. And the judge said, you know, software can rise to a copyrightable work, but it needn't. And 12 bytes just doesn't reach to copyrightable status. So Lexmark, they lost their case. And actually, funny story, Static Controls now owns Lexmark. But now let's talk about HP. In 2003, a company like Lexmark, they couldn't really afford to put real heavy controllers in their semi-disposable cartridges because computers were expensive back then. But that's not a barrier today. If you're a company like HP, your toner cartridges or inkjet cartridges, they've got like a full-on system on a chip. It's got 50 to 100,000 lines of code. It's got an embedded Linux. It's probably got like a full operating system full of stuff they're not even using. Like toner cartridges these days have like graphics drivers and network stacks and, you know, like kind of everything you need to like just take that chip out and use it as an embedded Linux, because that's all it is, right? It's a little embedded Linux, probably running an insecure version of BusyBox. And HP, in March 2016, they did something super shenanigan-y. They pushed a security update out to millions of users, everyone who had an OfficeJet or an OfficeJet Pro. Now, running security updates on your printer is a really good idea. In 2011, this guy, Ang Kui, published a paper called Print Me If You Dare. So he investigated how firmware updates work on HP printers. So the way that you flash the firmware on an HP printer is you send it a PostScript file, just like a page description file, and then you have a comment that says, everything after this is an operating system. And then it just takes that, it doesn't even do a checksum, and it flashes its ROMs, right? And Kui, he wasn't like a low-level programmer, but he found some like Perl interpreter that would like transcode some high-level language into, you know, printer firmware language, assembler, whatever it was. And he wrote a program that he could hide in a Word file that would flash your HP ROMs once you printed the file, so that it would accept all future updates, it would ingest them, it would acknowledge that it received them, it would report that it installed them, but it would just discard them, so you could never move his operating system out of your printer. And then what it would do is crawl your LAN inside your firewall, looking for devices with known zero-day vulnerabilities. It would compromise and take those over, and then it would open a reverse shell to his laptop so he could exfiltrate all the data from your LAN. So all he needed to do was send your HR department a file that says call resume.doc, and as soon as they printed it, you know, then he would own it. He didn't even have to do that because he used Shodan, the search engine for open network devices, and found something like 4 million HP printers that were just publishing queues to the internet, and some of them had awesome names like payroll. And so you really want people to update their printers, right? It's a big deal. A non-updated printer can really put you in harm's way. And so what did this update do? Well, when you clicked run this update, it did what every security update you've ever installed did, which is nothing as far as you could tell, right? A progress bar scrolled, it rebooted it, and then a version number incremented on the boot screen. But in all other ways, the printer behaved exactly as it always had. But inside, something new was happening. That printer had started a countdown that lasted 6 months. And 6 months later, in September of 2016, all of those printers woke up one morning and checked to see whether they had original cartridges in them or third-party cartridges in them. And if they had third-party cartridges, they rejected them. Right? So they didn't want people to immediately figure out what had gone on. So they had a six-month fuse burning so that they could get high compliance on these updates before it kicked in. People didn't know what had gone on. They thought that they had a faulty cartridge, they swapped in other known good cartridges, they threw away their printers. Eventually, HP copped to it. I helped run a campaign, 15,000 people wrote letters to HP complaining about it. HP said that they would never do it again without telling you, but that they might do it again. And then they did it again and they didn't tell anyone. And then Epson just did it again. So everyone's gotten in on the act here. HP had deliberately reached into millions of their customers' homes and just sort of whacked them upside the head for the sin of not arranging their affairs to the benefit of HP's shareholders. And, you know, they were pretty unrepentant about it when I talked to them about it. They said, well, we never sold you a printer with the promise that you could use third-party ink, right? And so we were just giving you what the box had said we were giving you, an HP printer. And part of the definition of an HP printer is that it runs HP ink. Now, it's not hard to figure out how to jailbreak an HP printer, right? If Anqui could do it, then so can you, or someone you know anyway. And certainly there's a lot of money to be made finding a sweet spot between the incredible margins that they command on ink and what the actual ink costs. And some of that margin could be thrown into R&D for like getting into an arms race with HP to defeat that. And that's how normally this stuff worked. If firms were like too obnoxious about this stuff, someone would spend the money to de-obnoxify their products. And then they would find a kind of equilibrium between like how awful they could be in the marketplace and how willing their customers would be to spend a little money to de-awfulize their products. But once you have an HP cartridge with a system on a chip and 50,000 lines of code and a copyrighted work and no ambiguity about whether or not that work is qualified for protection under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, then none of that stuff happens. Then you just get HP reaching into your house and breaking your stuff. No one wants to invest in a company to manufacture third-party ink or refilling kits if that company can face $500,000 fines and 5-year prison sentences for every act of circumvention. So printer cartridges, they're not the only things with embedded software these days. As Mark Andreessen has told us, software is eating the world. And it's hard to overstate the cheapness of computing power. I mean, those systems on a chip with a full-on Linux stack, they're like 25%, 25 cents to buy those things in bulk. And they're in everything. Now, it's fashionable to say these days of the techlash and Cambridge Analytica and worrying about Facebook and ad-supported businesses that when you're not paying for the product, you're the product. But what we're discovering is that even when you pay for the product, sometimes you're still the product, right? If the product's business model is we're going to sell you this product, but then you can only get it fixed by people that we charge a licensing fee to be an authorized repair depot. You're the product. Or if the process, if the product's business model is, we're going to sell you this product, but you can only buy consumables from people who've paid us a royalty, then you're the product. Or if you are buying the device from someone and then their business model is, we're going to charge independent software vendors a royalty to list their products in our store, and we're going to make it a felony to sell you a product without going through our store, then you're the product, right? You are the product whether or not you're paying for the product increasingly. So right now in 18 states across the US, there are pending right to repair bills that would force companies to allow third parties to affect service. This is a generally good policy. For one thing, they create local jobs. Getting something repaired in your community creates a job in your community. People don't typically send their cars or their phones overseas to cheap labor markets to get them repaired. They take them to the person on the corner. And those people on the corner are creating jobs at a much higher rate than they would if those devices were just thrown away. So the Repair Coalition has done some numbers, and they say that if you recycle a kiloton of electronic waste, you create 15 low-quality jobs in sweatshops overseas. And if you repair it, you create 250 high-quality jobs in your neighborhood. And the Right to Repair Coalition has been fought at every stage by every hardware manufacturer you can imagine. It's kind of an object lesson about how many firms have decided that monopolizing service and parts and materials is part of an integral part of their business. So, you know, Apple has just changed the digitizers on their iPhones so that not only can you not use a third-party iPhone screen to repair an iPhone, you can't use a donor screen from another iPhone to repair an iPhone. That Apple has to send you an unlock code to take a screen from an otherwise dead iPhone and put it on an iPhone with a broken screen and get it working again. So on the one hand, we have these firms that are monopolizing markets using parts and service. Sometimes they're monopolizing markets using surveillance as well. And that surveillance is affected not through advertising, but through locks. So like your cable box increasingly is a surveillance tool that spies on all your viewing habits. Sometimes they gather data about you and your home by crawling your LAN and gathering that data and exfiltrating them. They're also sometimes gathering data about the files that you load onto your TV through side loading and so on. And those cable boxes are illegal to unlock because they have some function where they stop you from, you know, recording videos with equipment of your choosing instead of the ones your cable operator has provided. And so because of that, they can invoke Section 1201 of the DMCA and Bill C-11 to make it a crime to unlock them. But that also means that that anti-feature where your cable box is spying on you while you watch TV, that's intact, right? No one can remove that feature. And it's not just, you know, home appliances that are getting into this thing. It's also industrial and agricultural equipment. So every 3 years, the US Copyright Office holds hearings on whether to allow some limited exceptions to bypass these locks. And in the last two cycles, 2015 and just now in 2018, one of the live questions has been whether farmers can jailbreak their John Deere tractors. So, you know, talk about paying for the product. A John Deere tractor is, you know, a $500,000 investment. So even if you pay for the product, you're still the product with your John Deere tractor, because when it breaks, even if you have the part and you swap it in, the part won't be recognized until a John Deere technician travels to your farm and enters an unlock key into the console of your John Deere tractor. Every time you turn it on, you have to click through a license agreement affirming that that is the regime under which you will subject yourself. The John Deere tractors do more than that. They're data gathering instruments. So John Deere tractors, they have location, centimeter accurate location awareness through a variety of positioning systems, including GPS. And they also have humidity sensors that are under the carriage that can measure the humidity of the soil they're traversing. And they have torque sensors on the wheels that measure the density of the soil. And so what this produces is a centimeter accurate soil density and humidity survey that's incredibly useful first for sowing your own field, for broadcasting seed, but it's also very useful for making regional predictions about crop yields. And because John Deere wants to monetize both of those things, the way that the tractors work by default is you can't get that data out of your tractor, even though you generate it by driving your tractor around your field. The way that you access that data in a very limited way for automating seed broadcasting is you buy an app in the John Deere App Store that comes from Monsanto. Monsanto is the licensor of the data, And Monsanto will sell you that data back to you if you buy their seed. So that's the only way you can access your own data about your tractor. But what you can't access is the regional data, because John Deere is aggregating that regional data and they're selling it into the futures market to do region-wide crop yield predictions. So, you know, you are the product. Very clearly, you are the product. Now, this doesn't produce like good outcomes. In addition to people paying over the odds for things that by all rights they should be able to enjoy, it also produces all kinds of weird unexpected cyberpunky outcomes. Like, there's alternative firmware for John Deere tractors. No one knows who wrote it, but it comes out of darknet sites based, as far as we can tell, in Ukraine. And farmers all over the world download mysterious firmware blobs from Ukraine and flash their tractors with it. This is probably not good food security policy. As a first approximation, this is probably not good food security policy. So, DRM has thus metastasized into cars, into tractors, into pacemakers, into implanted defibrillators, into insulin pumps, into thermostats, into baby monitors, into voting machines. This premiered at the 2016 CES. It's the Internet of Things rectal thermometer. We have DRM up the literal non-figurative ass now. So that sucks, but what does it have to do with science? So DRM, the way that it works kind of conceptually, these copyright locks, is it works by hiding keys in user-accessible equipment. So if you know a little about crypto, you'll know that we usually talk about this high-level example where you have Alice and Bob and Carol. Alice and Bob are friends. Carol is nefarious and wants to eavesdrop on Alice and Bob. And Alice and Bob make some assumptions about Carol. So they assume that Carol knows what cipher they're using and how it works, because it would be really foolish to trust an unpublished, non-peer-reviewed cipher with an important secret, right? So you have to expose your cipher to adversarial peer review for the same reason that all knowledge has to be subjected to adversarial peer review. This is a thing we've known since the Enlightenment, right? Before the Enlightenment, we had a thing that looked a lot like science. It was called alchemy. They did things that were very similar to what you folks do here. They observed a phenomenon in the universe. They hypothesized a causal relationship between that phenomenon. They designed an experiment to test the phenomenon. They ran the experiment, and this is where it differs. They never told anyone what they thought they'd learned, right? And because, like, the single most profound human ability is our capacity to kid ourselves, they assumed that any gap between what they expected and what they saw was a rounding error, and they fudged it up to, yeah, I was probably right. And that's how every alchemist discovered for himself in the hardest way possible that you shouldn't drink mercury. And, you know, the Enlightenment is like, it's the moment where you just start publishing, right? And that converts the base metal of superstition into the precious metal of science, is like subjecting stuff to adversarial peer review. So Alice and Bob tell Carol what cipher they're using. In fact, they invite Carol to tell them all the mistakes they might have made in the cipher, right? They expose it not just to their friends, but to their enemies, because your friends might want to give you a pass, but your enemies are definitely going to be looking for reasons to call you an idiot. And so they let Carol look at all of their workings to make sure that they've got a solid cipher. They also assume Carol can get the enciphered message because they're using the public internet, right? So Carol might like be someone on the same Wi-Fi segment as them, or just someone in range of the Wi-Fi segment, or she might be a state-level adversary who's got access to the backbone, or if, you know, there's a satellite segment that their communications travels on, maybe she's just on the same continent as them. And so she's in the footprint of the satellite and she can intercept the message. So Alice and Bob, they know that Carol can get the message, and they know that Carol knows how they scramble the message, but they remain secure in their belief about the privacy of that and integrity of that message because they don't tell Carol what the key is. And, you know, at least for so long as we're still using classical computers, modern cipher systems will let you take, you know, your pocket distraction rectangle and you take a picture with it, and with doing so little work that the phone doesn't even get noticeably warmer, you now encipher that message so thoroughly that, like, if all the hydrogen atoms were computers and they did nothing until the Stella-Faris period but try and brute force the key, you would run out of universe orders of magnitude in time before you ran out of keys. So long as, like, no one here is inventing practical quantum computers, we're okay. Don't do that. Well, no, do it, but we'll talk about it later. Alice and Bob, they're very secure because the key doesn't get into Carol's hands, so they feel like Carol will never find out. what the clear text of their message is. But Voodoo Crypto, the crypto that we get in digital rights management system, it just has Alice and Bob, right? So like, Bob is Netflix. Alice is everybody in the world. Netflix wants to send everybody in the world a movie, but Netflix doesn't want them to save the movie to their hard drive. And so Netflix enciphers the movie. But we won't pay for the movie unless we can make a clear text of it, because they're less interesting when they're scrambled. And so Netflix sends us all a program, like anyone who wants. You just sign up for a free Netflix trial account, and Netflix will send you the program. And somewhere in that program is the key. And then Netflix assumes that you will never recover the key from the program that they've given you to run on your own equipment, away from them, and out of any direct scrutiny, right? They've hidden keys in adversary accessible equipment. So the technical term for this in security research is wishful thinking, right? Like, even really, really good safes are kept in bank vaults. We don't keep them in bank robbers' living rooms, right? Because we understand that if you hide something in equipment that you give to your adversary, and then you say to your adversary, just go anywhere you want, take as long as you want, I'm not looking, and see if you can recover the keys, your adversary is probably going to recover your keys. Like, maybe the adversary is like a bored grad student with like nothing to do this weekend, a bunch of undergrads hanging around like a bad smell, and an electron tunneling microscope, right? Eventually those keys are going to leak. So it's break once, break everywhere, and off it goes. So even well-designed DRM, it gets broken really fast. You know, it's built over the course of years by skilled engineers at a cost of millions, and it's broken in hours by teenagers using hobbyist equipment, because it's a fool's errand to hide secrets in user-accessible equipment. But it also has this important security dimension, because the way that these systems work is by running processes and having files and having elements that are designed for the user not to be able to detect them or alter them or terminate them, right? If there's like a program on your desktop called hell9000.exe, you will drag it into the trash, right? The only way this stuff works is if the process name is obfuscated or doesn't show up in the process monitor at all. Ideally, you're using some kind of like hypervisor where you have like a ring minus one, like a process that runs below the kernel that is not visible to you or in any way user accessible, and that's where you hide all the good stuff. Well, what happens when a bad actor gets inside ring minus one, gets inside the space that the user themselves is not supposed to be able to see? Well, no user process will be able to tell that their computer has been compromised, and no user action will be able to root out the compromise, because by design, this system is designed to hide its workings from the owner of the system. So this is not a theoretical risk. We see it happening again and again. The most kind of dramatic example was in 2005. Sony BMG was then one of the big record labels, and they shipped out 6 million audio CDs, 51 titles, including a Celine Dion CD. There's a Canadian connection. And they shipped it out, and it had an auto-run program on a separate session on the CD. So when you put it in, your CD drive would check to see whether there was a data sector, and it would find it, and it had an auto-run program. What that auto-run program did was it exploited a zero-day vulnerability in the Windows kernel, and it patched Windows so that Windows could no longer see programs that were prepended with this string, $SYS$. So any file that had that beforehand, it wouldn't show up in file listings. So if you ask the computer to enumerate the files, you know, the dir or just open up a window, these files wouldn't show up. And then if you looked at your process monitor, any process running wouldn't show up. So they had a little toy program that checked to see whether you were ripping a CD. And if you did, it would like try and terminate that process. And it just started with one of these. And they wrote it into your startup folder, and you couldn't see it there. And so it would run every time your computer booted. So immediately after the world got news that they had infected all these computers with this, 300,000 US government and military networks there was evidence that they had this. We could tell because there was a DNS lookup that took place, so we could see where the DNS queries were coming from for the this program. 300,000 of them were infected with it. And like within days of this becoming publicly known, malware writers started prepending all of their viruses with this string because it would be invisible to the operating system, right? You blow a hole in the immune system and you get you know, parasites, right? Of course you do, right? That's how ecosystems work. And, you know, this is bad, but what's worse is that the law that protects digital rights management systems also prohibits disclosures of their defects. Because if I tell you that this is what you should look for in order to go back to ripping CDs, then you know how to get around the access control. And so revealing, trafficking in knowledge about how to bypass an access control is a felony punishable by a $500,000 fine and a 5-year prison sentence. The people who originally discovered this did not disclose it. 3 months later, someone else disclosed it because they got tired of working with their general counsel. They took a risk and disclosed it. But in the 3 months between its initial discovery and its disclosure, it spread to millions of computers around the world. So in 2015 and again in 2018, the U.S. Copyright Office held their hearings on this rule, DMCA 1201, and security researchers, really like the who's who of U.S. and global security researchers, came forward to say that they are routinely now discovering defects in systems that have some form of copyright access control, because our systems are very blended, right? Your phone is not just, you know, an entertainment device, it's also a system for accessing your bank details and your doctor, and it's got a camera and a microphone, and you take it into the toilet. I mean, it's got like a lot of different uses, right? And so the chances that it has one use that overlaps with someone's copyright access control are pretty high because of the general purposeness of these devices. And they came forward, Ed Felton, who was the deputy CTO of the White House under Obama and is a Princeton cryptographer, Matt Blaze who's the voting machine researcher, Matt Green from Johns Hopkins, Bruce Schneier, the eminent cryptographer, Jay Radcliffe from Rapid7, who incidentally is a type 1 diabetic who's discovered showstopper bugs in implanted insulin pumps that make them wirelessly attackable from 30 feet. That can cause them to dump all of their insulin at once and kill the person wearing it in their boots, which he then had to go through all kinds of hoops to disclose because there was an access control that might have exposed him to DMCA liability. So all of these people came forward and they said that we don't get to disclose without taking legal risk, and our general counsel often stops us or slows us in our disclosures. So what this system does is it doesn't just give firms the right to force you to arrange your affairs to the benefit of their shareholders. It also gives firms the right to assert a veto over criticism of their products. So again, like, we may say there are irresponsible ways to make security disclosures, and there should be some ethics and some managed process around that. But I don't think anyone who's kind of an honest broker would ever say that firms are likely to be good custodians of bad news about their own products. That bad news that might affect your share price or your profitability is something that you, the firm, should be able to decide the time and manner of the disclosure of. Now, preventing disclosure does not prevent discovery. This is a thing we actually now have some empirical basis for. It's been a kind of axiom of security research that, like, forcing people not to disclose would probably not protect you, because someone else would independently rediscover the defect that you had suppressed, and they would weaponize it even if the discoverer you know about didn't. But actually now we have some solid data thanks to the CIA leaks. So the CIA leaks of Vault 7 and Vault 8 are these leaks of these vulnerabilities that the CIA bought or discovered but didn't disclose to the manufacturers. So we only have like one internet, and we only have one computing architecture, and we only have a couple of operating systems. And so if you're the CIA and you discover a defect, on the one hand, it makes the people you're supposed to be protecting, it makes them vulnerable, but it also gives you a means to render vulnerable your own adversaries. And they perform this internal calculus whenever they discover a defect about whether to patch it and protect the people that they're charged with protecting, or whether to suppress its disclosure so that they can attack the people who they fear might attack the people that they're supposed to be protecting. So this doctrine, it has a name. It's called no bus. No one but us is smart enough to discover this particular defect, so we'll keep it a secret. And with the Vault 7 and Vault 8 leaks, we could see the rate of independent rediscovery, because we could see that the CIA starts exploiting this defect in this year. This is when they discover it, or this month. And then we see an in-the-wild separate exploit of this that security researchers detected and disclosed. at this date. And we can make an inference that that's the date at which it was independently rediscovered by one of the CIA's adversaries. So the rate of independent rediscovery for like the median defect is about 20% per year. So any defect that you discover has about a 1 in 5 chance every year of being rediscovered, weaponized, and used to attack you. So suppressing these security defects, it doesn't stop the security defects from being exploited. It just means that we don't find out that they're being exploited until they're being exploited so visibly and so egregiously that they can no longer be denied. Someone risks arrest and comes forward, or fines and comes forward and says, I know what's going on. I know why this is happening. It's this bug that I found that my general counsel wouldn't let me disclose. I'm going to tell you about it today. So putting technology out of reach of independent security scrutiny has real grave risks. So a good example, last year, there's a security researcher named Brian Krebs. He makes a kind of specialty out of outing the individuals who are kind of usually petty grifters who are responsible for really widespread crimes. And he found these guys who are running a little denial of service for hire business in Israel, where you could give them a little bit of money. Like say you wanted to blackmail a casino in the British Virgin Islands, and you wanted to shut down their servers just before Super Bowl, and then say, give me $1,000 or I'm not gonna let your servers come back up. You could pay these two petty grifters in Israel. They were like mid-20s dum-dums, and they would like take down this site until you said to bring it back up again. And Krebs identified them by name, figured out who they were, identified them by name. They weren't very good at their tradecraft. And then they hit him with a 620 gigabit per second traffic flood. Right? That is the kind of attack that's normally associated with powerful nation states attacking other powerful nation states. The worm that they used to do this, it was a botnet that crawled from Internet of Things device to Internet of Things device. It had its origins in a couple of different dumb petty grifters whose con was that they sold denial of service attack to people who ran Minecraft servers, and they wanted a botnet that could take down Minecraft servers that other people were protecting so that they could go, you see, the people you're paying are no good. You should buy your service from us, right? So this is like, we now have like Dr. Evil grade super weapons in the hands of Scooby-Doo villains, right? As a consequence of suppressing the disclosure and remediation of defects. And so that's what happens when devices that we own are used to attack third parties. But it gets even worse than when the devices that you own are used to attack you. So in February 2017, researchers came forward to disclose what had happened with Cloud Pets. So Cloud Pets was a Romanian listed company. They had about 2 million customers, mostly in the US and Canada and Europe. They made internet connected soft toys. They had a little Wi-Fi access point and an app that paired with it. And the way that it worked is you put the soft toy on your Wi-Fi, and then you paired it with an app, and then your kid could hug the soft toy and say something to it, and it would come out the app. So it was like a push to talk. And then you could take the app and push a button, and you could make your voice come out of the soft toy. So they stored all of their user data, credit card numbers, home addresses, email addresses, and all the messages and all the passwords in the clear on an unprotected, unpassword-protected Amazon Web Services bucket. And researchers had discovered this bucket and had been trying desperately to contact the company whose share price was down 98% at that point. And it seems like no one was even working for them. Like someone's credit card was still paying for the Amazon service, but nobody was answering the email. One of the ways that we know no one was answering the email is this database, in addition to having all the sensitive information, had a bunch of messages that had been written by petty grifters that said, haha, I have stolen your database. Give me 11 Bitcoin by Tuesday or I'm gonna put it on the dark web. And then someone else came along a month later and said, haha, I've stolen your database. No one saw the messages. So this sounds like horrible, and it's horrible, but it's worse because like these soft toys are not just used for like anodyne messages, mommy, don't forget the milk. Also stuff like, don't worry kid, mommy's in the hospital, but it's gonna be fine, right? Really personal, intense stuff that traversed between parents and kids that these people had not taken due care with and whose sins could not be disclosed until people became emboldened by the lack of action and risked terrible reprisals to warn all of us that these toys, of which there were millions, we're still out there and we're not fit for purpose. And of course, it doesn't have to be a toy, it can just be the baby monitor. So baby monitors, every year at DEF CON and the other hacker conferences, people show up and talk about how insecure baby monitors are. Baby monitors are super insecure. My favorite example of it, though, comes from a kind of 24-hour news cycle in San Francisco in January 2016. There was a parent who had a toddler, and the toddler kept complaining that the phone in his room was scaring him at night. Right? That's what he called his baby monitor. And so one night, mom is walking by the room. She hears a rando swearing at her kid through the baby monitor. She walks into the room. It's a steerable camera. It pivots around to look at her. Some stranger's voice says, uh-oh, mommy's here. And then it turned itself off, and she never heard who it was again. And if you've ever had a kid, and you've been in the baby's room, feeding the kid, putting them to bed, just talking with your partner, you know that's a very intimate context to have strangers invading, even if you can't imagine a way that might create an immediate harm, like they don't get your credit card number off of it or whatever, maybe there's nothing ransomable off of it. It's a grotesque, profound invasion to have third parties being able to access this. And again, security researchers often know about these defects long before they disclose these defects. And of course, we now have the internet of sex things. LoveSense is a company that has repeatedly been discovered having defects in its sex toys. They settled a multi-million-dollar suit in October 2017 over Bluetooth-enabled butt plugs that could be remotely sensed and hacked. You can war drive for butt plugs by walking around and looking for their Bluetooth beacons and find out their maps now of which houses have butt plugs in them. And then after paying the settlement in September of 2017, in November of 2017, they announced or admitted that security researchers were right. These things were accidentally making sound recordings of you having sex and then just leaving them on your phone in an unencrypted directory. So if that sounds bad, then there's these guys. This is the Simi. It's an orthoscopic sex toy. So it's a dildo with a camera on the end of it. And it has a Wi-Fi access point. The Wi-Fi access point's password is 00000000. And it has an unpatched version of BusyBox, which is a common Unix utility used for Internet of Things devices that has known defects. You can then use it to have it exfiltrate all of the data, like all of the video streams, to any arbitrary place on the internet. And they were repeatedly warned over the course of months before security researchers came forward and they admitted that this was a defect, but they ignored the security researchers until they came forward. You may remember summer 2015, Chrysler had to recall 1.25 million Jeeps. So these Jeeps had an internet access point in them. A lot of modern cars have these now. They have a SIM, and then they have a touch panel, and you can unlock a day's worth of in-car Wi-Fi to like keep the kids quiet on long drives by giving them a credit card number through a console. So their security model for this thing was that it was on the smallest and least popular of all the American cellular networks, Sprint, and they just assumed no one else was on Sprint. And they, to save money, they cross-connected this Wi-Fi access point to the transmission, steering, brakes, and electronics of the car, which means that anyone who could tunnel into Sprint's network could then drive the car. And that's why they had to recall 1.25 million of them. And now you'd think that like by now we'd have learned that designing devices to allow firms a veto over their defects was a bad idea, but no, we just keep making it worse. So last year, you probably know about the W3C. They're an amazing standards body that makes open standards for the web. They have been at it for 25 years, and their mission is to make sure that everything you need to know to make a web browser is open and standardized so that anyone can make a web browser, anyone can compete, no one can lock in or own parts of the web. And HTML5 is the latest and greatest version of HTML, and one of the things that it does is it sunsets all of the APIs that browsers used to use to hook in digital rights management systems to control how you used videos, because those hooks went so deep into the operating system that when they had bugs, it allowed people to seize control of your computer when you visited their web page. So we don't want any deep hooks into the operating system from this thing that's exposed to the public internet where there's lots of bad stuff and where anyone can enter. And so as soon as it became obvious that it was going to be technically impossible to hook up DRM to the web anymore, Netflix led a coalition of giant rights holders, including the BBC and a few other companies, and they went to the W3C and they said, we will no longer make video available in browsers, only in apps, unless you standardize an API that lets us do DRM in browsers. Now, this had lots of problems from an open standards perspective. The API didn't actually specify the digital rights management point, so you still couldn't implement a browser, so it would create fragmentation and stuff, but like that's not... That only like wonks who care about competition and open standards care about that. The stuff that was really deadly is that once you standardized DRM for browsers, it meant that 3 billion people would have a tool that they used all day, every day to manage every part of their life, and then that tool would have an unauditable attack surface that security researchers would have to treat as a no-go zone. And so I work, as you heard, part-time for Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we went to the W3C and we proposed a compromise. We said, by all means, if you must standardize DRM to stop from being held hostage, then do. But make everyone who participates in that process promise not to invoke anti-circumvention laws like Bill C-11, the DMCA, the European Union Copyright Directive, Article 6, not to invoke them against people who are not violating any law. Right? Let people do security research. Let people make competitive features. Let people address people who are have disabilities who may need to adapt their browsers. So you may ask yourself, like, why would you need to adapt it for people who have disabilities? The companies are already subtitling and they're experimenting with all kinds of things like descriptive tracks, many paranoid people in the world, I don't get my mail at home. I get it at a private mailbox. And so I go to my private mailbox every day. I talk to the person who works there. It's one of three people I talk to reliably every day, my wife, the barista, and the person who works in my private mailbox. And her name is Jennifer, and she has photosensitive epilepsy. And the only time she's ever been hospitalized for seizures was while watching a Netflix DVD. And it triggered 5 consecutive grand mal seizures that hospitalized her. It was the worst seizure she's ever experienced in her life. It is not hard to write a look-ahead routine that checks to see whether or not there's some strobe effects coming up in a video to buffer the video and warn you, or damp the strobe effect, or do one of a million mitigation strategies. In the same way that it's not hard to take a video and shift its gamut so that people who have colorblindness can have all of the color shifted into a gamut that they can see. Or future adaptations that we can barely dream of that machine learning and other advanced techniques are starting to unlock. You and I, even if you're able-bodied today, you're only temporarily able-bodied. If you live long enough, you will have some sensory or physical disability. And when we allow firms to monopolize the ability to add features to their products, we remove the possibility that we or people that we work with will be able to adapt those products for our needs, as our own ableness declines with age or through injury or disease. So what's interesting about this is that Netflix asserted that they had a business model and that that business model had done good in the world. People like Netflix. They're a super successful company. And that if you want super successful companies, you have to allow them to defend their business models. But the irony of this is how Netflix became successful. So you may remember the red envelopes. Netflix started out as a company that put DVDs in red envelopes and mailed them around the world, right? Without paying for each time they mailed them. They just bought them once. They bought it. They owned it. They got to choose how they used it. The motion picture studios, when they started doing this, they called it theft. They argued that Netflix had no business doing it. But because they didn't have a law that would allow them to convert their preference, that everyone who watched a DVD had to buy the DVD instead of renting it from someone else who'd bought the DVD, because they couldn't convert that preference to a right, they weren't able to stop Netflix. Netflix, having waxed fat and successful from having frustrated the business model of the motion picture studios, now argue that no one should be able to frustrate their business model, right? Every pirate wants to be an admiral. That's not unusual. The unusual thing is that we're starting to listen to them when they say, well, when I did it, that was part of our legitimate progress to a better future. When you do it to me, that's just theft. And anti-circumvention gives firms a very powerful motive to deploy digital rights management, kind of the minimum viable digital rights management they need to invoke Bill C-11, DMCA 1201. If you add a kind of single molecule thick layer of digital rights management, just enough to let you invoke the statute, then you can assert a monopoly over any or all parts of the ecosystem around your product, the parts, the service, the consumables, and so on, and also bad news about malware. Also bad news about the mistakes that you made in your products and the defects that it has. So software is eating the world, right? The right to know how something works, the right to interrogate the world and discover how it works, that very right is under attack. And there is no real functional difference between the computers that we use to do experimental work at fancy elite institutions and the computers that this stuff is embedded in, right? It's just a laptop, right? You don't go to the store and buy the science laptop, right? You just buy the laptop. And your right to just peer inside it, even out of simple curiosity, is under attack. But even more importantly, your need to look into these things and see how they work, because the abstractions that these things operate at are distorting your results. That's under attack too, right? Like when you're building very sensitive scientific instruments, for example, it's not enough to work in the approximations of how the computer works that's in the abstraction layers and in the high-level programming languages and in the conceptual models of the engineering. Sometimes you gotta get out like a tape measure and measure the fiber optic link and figure out whether or not it's introducing a delay that's distorting your results. You can't do the kind of science you do unless you can look hard at your instruments. And your instruments are just general purpose computers. And that general purposeness itself is under attack. Right? The thing that you do, where you observe a phenomenon in the universe, and you postulate a causal relationship, and you perform an experiment, and you tell people about what you found, that is under attack. And it's not a thing that we can survive. So there's this thing behavioral economists talk about. It's called the Ulysses Pact. Ulysses was an early hacker back in the Ulyssian days. If you were sailing through the siren-infested waters and you didn't want their song to lure you to jumping to your death, you had an established protocol, which was to fill your ears with wax. But Ulysses, being a hacker, wanted to hear what their song sounded like. So he devised a second protocol. He had his sailors tie him to the mast. What he did was he took his strong self, the self who wasn't under the influence of the sirens, and he used it to protect himself from his weak self, the weak self that he knew was coming when the sirens would weaken his resolve. We do this all the time, right? If you've ever started a diet and thrown away all the Oreos, that's a Ulysses Pact, right? So in the work that you do, in the context that you live in the polity that you're a part of, you are going to be asked again and again, under conditions in which you're tired or distracted or pressurized, to give a pass to the idea that devices should be designed to treat you as their adversaries, that the convenience of having a device with an integrated ecosystem is worth giving up the freedom to decide whether you want to use that ecosystem or choose a better one. And so I would like you now, in this moment where you're strong, just think about a Ulysses Pact that you can use to defend yourself against those moments when you're weak. And the Ulysses Pact I want to propose, it has two parts. The first one is that devices should always obey their owners. It's not because I can't imagine scenarios in which owners order their devices to do foolish things. I can imagine lots of those scenarios, right? I used to be a systems administrator, network administrator. We have an acronym, TABCAC, problem exists between keyboard and chair. Users of devices can do all kinds of dumb things. But designing a device to treat its owner as an adversary and to run processes that are deliberately designed so the owner can't find out what they are, can't modify them, and can't terminate them, that the mischief potential for a device that deliberately blinds its users to its operations are infinitely worse than the mischief potential of someone opting to do something foolish with their own device. By all means, have lots of "are you sure" dialogues in the tools that you use, but always make sure that there's a chance to type yes. Second part is that it should always be lawful to disclose defects. Not because I can't imagine really foolish reckless ways to disclose defects. There are lots of examples of that. But suppressing the ability of people to disclose defects does not make the defects more managed in their disclosure. What we have today is the worst of all worlds. It's approximately speaking, you know, illegal to disclose defects without manufacturer approval if there's some kind of digital rights management system. And so what security researchers increasingly do when they discover those defects is instead of contacting the researcher and saying, hey, you fools, you made this dumb mistake and I've written a paper about it and I'm going to give it a DEF CON in 3 months, you better have a patch ready. Now what they do is they just anonymously put it on Pastebin. That is not managed disclosure. That is the opposite of managed disclosure. And so if we want firms to entice people who discover defects to disclose those defects in managed ways, the best way to do that is to give people who don't trust the firms the right to opt out of the system. Right? Today, all the best firms have, to their credit, good bug bounty programs. Right? They will pay you some money. They will give you some credit. They will do all kinds of things, except when they don't, except when they go off script, except when they lie, except when they cheat, except when they threaten. But most of the time they do, except when they don't. The reason they have those systems is because the alternative is that people just drop the bugs. They just publish them, right? They have to entice people. They have to prove that they're good actors. They have to establish a track record. They have to prove to security researchers who, by and large, are in it to protect the people they love and make sure that the people that they love aren't exposed to rampant defects and products that they rely on. The way that they do that is to demonstrate that when they get those defects, they take them seriously and remediate them and don't poo-poo them and don't say, oh, no one is smart enough to find that defect apart from you and we can just leave it intact and it's, you know, we don't have to issue an out-of-cycle patch or whatever. That is the only way that we get firms to discipline themselves and to comport themselves well. Giving firms a veto over defects only reduces the likelihood that they will be good custodians of the defects that are disclosed to them. So I ask you to take this on board as a Ulysses Pact, as people who are technically knowledgeable, who spend all days working with computers, who have to understand their underlying workings, who people come to for advice about computers, who are a source of information, and I ask you to be a hardliner for it. If you are not being called an unrealistic, stiff-necked ideologue, a fanatic about these principles, I want to say you're not trying hard enough. This is not the kind of fight that we win. This is the kind of fight that we fight. Because computers are colonizing the world, right? Everything that we use today is a computer in a fancy case, right? Computers are like the key component of seismic dampers. Skyscrapers on Bay Street, those are computers we put bankers into. Right? Pacemakers are computers you put in your chest. A car is a computer you put your body into and drive at 80 kilometers an hour or 10 kilometers an hour on the 401. Right? You live in a world made of computers. And so computers will create every problem that we have or have a nexus with every problem that we have from now on, because everything we have a problem with will have a computer in it. And at every turn, there will be someone who will want to say, can't you just design me a computer that is almost Turing complete? A computer that can run every program we can express symbolically, except for this one that's giving me heartburn, right? And at every turn, there will be someone whose closest approximation to that is a computer that treats its owner as an adversary, that tries to stop its owner from running certain programs, that spies on its owner and hides from its owner, and whose defects are illegal to disclose, because if you know how the computer is doing it, then you can circumvent that control. So you folks, you're the technological elite, right? You're here in the Silicon Valley of the North. You are here in this august institution. You understand how computers work. You are the first line that everyone comes to in your political life, in your personal life, in your professional life to explain how the computers work, to fix stuff. You've probably not had a dinner with relatives in some years that didn't involve fixing their Wi-Fi. You people are in a position to powerfully influence the way that we debate this. And this debate is only getting started. It will only continue. The foreseeable future is going to be filled with people who are going to be asking you, well, why shouldn't we design backdoors into all of our systems after those terrorists were caught using them? Why shouldn't Apple, having made that device, get to decide whose apps can go on it? Why shouldn't manufacturers get to decide who can fix your car? And it's your job to explain them, to them what's going on. It's your job to contact your MP the next time a bill like Bill C-51 or Bill C-11 are proposed. It's your job because no one else can do it. You're the front line, right? You are in possession of the rare, poorly distributed knowledge that we need to have this debate go forward well, because this is a kind of public health problem, right? This is a problem in which the poor choices that the people around us make redound on us. This is a problem in which the consequences of those poor choices are not felt for a long time until after the choices have been made. And so it is up to us to make people cognizant of those consequences before those consequences are felt. Because by the time those consequences are felt, it may be too late. You can think of it as being like climate change, right? We are accumulating a carbon debt. At a certain point, that carbon debt will be undeniable. You know, even to the most hard-bitten Alberta Tory, those consequences will be undeniable. The point at which those consequences are undeniable will be probably too late to do something about it. Long before we reach that point of undeniability, we need to have a broadly shared consensus that we have to do something about it. We're incurring a technological debt in the name of shoring up petty monopolies, of devices that are designed to be insecure from the get-go, that are designed to resist end-user modification and scrutiny, that are legally and technically designed to frustrate the kind of remediation that we need to make sure those devices work well. And it's up to you to be the front lines in changing that, in making people aware that there is a problem before the problem is undeniable. And there are organizations that can help you with this. This is not a thing we're going to solve on our own, in the same way that you're not going to recycle your way out of climate change. It's also not a way, you're also not going to solve this problem on your own by going to the constituency meetings of your MP, although you should do that too. But organizations like openmedia.ca and CIPIC and Citizen Lab at the U of T, the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, the Free Software Foundation, and other organizations like them all around the world, they need your support. They need your moral support. You can join their mailing lists and they will write to you when there's pending legislation in your territory and help tell you what you should be discussing with your MP and give you the phone number for your MP to call them. And they need your financial support as well. You may have noticed that every month you look at your bills and you realize that you spend a bunch of money subsidizing corporations that want to destroy the future you'd like to live in. One way that you can improve your chances of living in that future is by hedging your bet. I take a roughly equivalent amount of money every month and give it to organizations trying to defend the future I'd like to live in. We need your support to help us win this race between the point of peak indifference and the point of no return. And I think we can do it. Thank you. So we have some time for questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you have anything to say about voting technologies? What's the chances that recently or in the near future before an election?
What's the likelihood that voting machines, you mean in the U.S., because here it's still paper voting, right? Or are you using voting machines here now?
I've used paper. I don't know. Talk about the U.S.
Well, so in the U.S. context, the voting machines are a dog's breakfast, for sure. And the voting machine vendors are really bad offenders for attacking security researchers. Ed Felton led a team that investigated the voting machines, the touchscreen machines that were used in Ohio in the 2014 midterms, and concluded that they didn't think the election should have been certified because those voting machines were so badly designed and had such poor tamper evidence and poor auditing logs. And there was some evidence that at least some of them had been tampered with. Voting machines have been like a kind of locus of very poor information security practices, in part, I think, because their use is kind of never disciplined by public scrutiny of their workings. So they don't have to disclose their source code. This is a thing that's actually in various model legislation that if you're a voting machine vendor, you have to disclose your source code for independent auditing. Right now, that argument tends to be won by voting machine companies that say, like, if we told you how it worked, you could figure out what the defects were and exploit it. And the answer is, even if you don't tell us how it works, we can figure out what the defects are and exploit it. So they don't publish their auditing code. A lot of them don't produce paper audit tapes, which is kind of like an obvious best practice that you produce a paper audit tape that can be manually examined to and compared to the total that the voting machine makes to see whether or not the audit tape and the voting machine are out by well, it should be, there shouldn't be out at all, but definitely if there are gross swings, then that's a thing that you should be able to tell by comparing an audit tape and a paper audit tape and the machine's tally. Physically, they're very poorly secured. There are a bunch of vendors whose physical security turned out to be a minibar key, a hotel minibar key, which is like a standard key you can buy on eBay for $10. And then that door opened up and exposed a USB port that if you put a USB stick in by design, it would just reboot and flash itself from that stick. So like they're really just very poorly made. One of the reasons they're so poorly made is actually probably a feature and not a bug, which is that voting is devolved to local election officials in the US, which means that in order to have a big effect on an election across multiple ridings or districts, you have to break into a lot of different systems, right? That fragmented nature probably has defended the elections by some amount because you can't just break into the central voting machine and change the tally that it records. There are all of these different ones. Now, that also means that they're managed in very variable ways. The Ohio election auditing that the Princeton team did, among other things, they found things like the machines were supposed to be, after they were flashed with the latest manufacturer firmware, they're supposed to be physically supervised the whole time. And they found that some of the people who were supposed to physically supervise them just put them in an unlocked garage for the weekend before the election. Right, like it was literally just supposed to be like a rent-a-cop sitting in a room with these machines, making sure no one walked in and started sticking USB sticks in them. They never did that, right? A lot of them transmit in the clear with no checksums when they transmit their tallies to like the tablet that tallies from all the machines in a precinct, and that was super disruptible. They're like giant, terrible dumpster fires. Lots of people just favor paper voting as the, you know, although you have to wait a little longer for the tally, it's paper voting with adversarial scrutineers from the different parties is a pretty stable way of doing that kind of tallying as well.
Questions from students to start with?
Yeah.
For general purpose computer, I have a laptop like everybody else, and I learned recently that there is another operating system running on my CPU because it's an Intel one.
Uh-huh.
I'm never going to run to get rid of it. So like the first law, even if I want to buy a computer, what am I going to do? Buy a Raspberry Pi and do all
computation
on Raspberry Pis?
Yeah. So what do you do about the fact that there's a second coprocessor that lives on your computer that is a It's usually a secure coprocessor to do some kind of bootloader checking and what's sometimes called introspection. So it's like it's a simpler computer that watches what the complicated computer does and produces telemetry that it can use to make judgments. And I think that conceptually, that's actually a nice idea. There's a guy named Bunny Huang, who's a security researcher. We at EFF are representing him in a lawsuit against the US government over Section 12.1 of the DMCA in an attempt to invalidate it. And one of the projects Bunny's done is this thing called the Novena, which is an open source hardware computer that runs for open source software. And he works in China. His kind of day job is helping people set up high specification electronic manufacturing in China, acting as a liaison. And there's a thing in China, Gongkai, which is the it's a kind of informal open source where people who make components like USB controllers just publish the source, but not under any particular license, and everyone just grabs it and uses it and just kind of this very informal thing. And he wanted to kind of merge that with the kind of Western conception of free and open source software. So he went and got all that stuff and either rewrote it or secured the copyright to it so that it was GNU compatible. It was free software and Gongkai. And everything in the Novena, these are like reference boards that you can buy, from the lowest level controllers to the bootloader all the way up, are open and free and can be verified against sources and so on. And he went on to build one of these secure coprocessor systems. So he and Edward Snowden have collaborated on a system called the Introspection Engine. And it's a daughter card that is a shim that fits inside an iPhone case and touches the six points on the logic board that you need to physically access to sense whether or not the phone's network interfaces are in operation. And it has a ribbon cable that runs out from the SIM cage and connects into like a battery case. And on the back of the battery case is an OLED screen and a system on a chip that has a free and open bootloader. And it tells you whether the actual detectable state of those network interfaces is the same as what the phone is telling you. And they made it as part of a response to a journalist who was working in Syria, whose phone location was used to walk mortar fire to her as she reported from the shelling of a civilian area and kill her. And they wanted to be able to give people an assurance. People were worried about state-level actors, an assurance that their devices were in a known good state. So conceptually, there's nothing wrong with designing a computer that has the second system on a chip. How do you make that happen? Well, obviously, we don't live in a perfect world yet. But one of the things that we've seen in the last year is a bunch of low-level silicon attacks on secure processors and on processors themselves, on pipelines and so on. And it's becoming really apparent that not letting users decide who they trusted to provide the firmware to go on those secure coprocessors doesn't make us more secure. It means that we're reliant on one firm that is as imperfect and frail as any other firm can be to not to never make a mistake, to have a kind of monotonic perfection that no one can attain. You know, in the same way that, like, yeah, maybe we all buy our sensitive sensing instruments from one firm and we trust them to be of high quality, you know, our lenses all come from Zeiss or whatever, we still are able to take those lenses and stick them in a machine to measure whether or not those lenses are true and have been well manufactured. And we need to be able to do that with these devices. So you're right, it's not possible right now to audit the source code of the or change it, of that system on a chip that sits alongside your CPU. But it has to be, right? Because it's like way too important to just assume that Intel's never going to make another mistake, right? Intel's going to make more mistakes. Like, even if there are, you know, even if Intel was the most robust and best of all the silicon vendors, which I think they've got a track record that's a bit spotty, but like, even if you thought of them as like your favorite semiconductor company, I think even the biggest Intel fanboy would not say, oh, well, they're perfect. They'll never make a mistake. They have to be disciplined by independent scrutiny.
More questions? Tanya.
So for the purposes of these anti-circumvention laws, what counts as DRM, given that none of these systems is actually secure?
So it's an effective means of access control to a copyrighted work. So effective is the key word. There hasn't been a lot. One of the things that has made it hard to kind of get our arms around this or change this is that there hasn't been a lot of litigation about it. There's been more threats, but not as much litigation. It's a lot of this is carried out through chilling effects. So Ed Felton, who I mentioned before, the Princeton guy, used to be the deputy CTO of the White House and did that voting audit. He, in 2002, I think, 2003, audited a digital rights management system for music called the Secure Digital Music Initiatives, SDMI. And SDMI was a consortium, and they'd offered a bug bounty, like $50,000 if you can break it. But he and his colleagues audited it. They're like, we're academics. We want a publishing credit, not a $50,000 check. So they submitted a paper to Usenix, and it was accepted to be like a prominently delivered paper at the second Usenix security conference. And the Recording Industry Association of America threatened to sue Ed, his team, and Usenix if they allowed this paper to be presented. And we were like, oh boy, this is good, right? Because no judge wants to tell a learned conference that they have to get permission from a recording industry executive to have papers about statistics, right? And the Recording Industry Association withdrew the threat as soon as EFF stepped up to represent Ed. So the few cases in which this goes to court where we can actually see whether a weak system qualifies for protection, it tends to be, like we were talking at lunch about people who submit papers who are like outsiders and maybe like just not completely there, not right in the head. So there was like this guy who had a Napster competitor called Aimster, who at one point he decided he would rot 13 all the file names in it and then sue the Recording Industry Association for crawling the network to see whether there were copyrighted works on his network. And he said, like, rotating the ASCII by 13 positions is a circumvention of my access control. And the court said, no, it's not, right? Like, they said, that's not an access control. So we have these, you know, these two cases where we asked, like, what's a copyrighted work? And we have this one case where we said, what's an access control? But in most cases, we don't get that. Now, it's not hard to like, the thing is, it's not hard to rise to the level where it's unambiguously an access control, even if it's one that has flaws in it. It's not hard to say like, I encrypt something and I hid the key in a way that would not be apparent to a normal user's operation of the system, right? Like, I think that that would probably be the thing that most potential plaintiffs would say to a judge is, I built a system, I scrambled the data at rest, I hid the key somewhere that is not in normally accessible user space, the user took an extraordinary step to recover the key, therefore, I had an effective means of access control, which they circumvented. I think that's probably like the, and that's a really low bar to hurdle. Now, as I mentioned, we've got this lawsuit pending in the US to invalidate the law, and it turns on two Supreme Court rulings in the US on copyright that tried to square the US constitutional provisions about free speech, the First Amendment, which prohibits Congress from limiting free expression, and copyright, which is a state monopoly on who can express certain ideas, or not ideas, but words, pictures, sounds, and so on. And we said, like, how do these, you know, we asked the Supreme Court to balance those two or explain the balance of the two. And the Supreme Court said that fair use, which is equivalent to fair dealing here, combined with the traditional contours of copyright, which is to say that copyright normally reaches to songs and video games and books and so on, but not to like toasters. That if so long as copyright is crafted to permit fair use and to hew to the traditional contours, it passes constitutional muster. But if it fails to do that, it doesn't. Well, the DMCA fails on both of those counts. You know, in particular, like the traditional contours, it's a complete disaster. Like the same principle that says you can't bypass your phone's operating system to use a third-party OS. There's like no conceptual legal difference between that and saying you can't bypass your toaster's vision system and toast third-party unauthorized bread, right? Like there's the, like, because the copyrighted work that you're circumventing, it's not the app, it's the controller that controls whose app you can use, right? So if you've got like a dishwasher that senses an RFID in the dish and decides whether or not you can wash this dish because it came from the manufacturer's dish store or not, there's no reason. If you want to say, well, an app store can be defended under this law, there's no reason that that dishwasher can't be defended under the law. So we think that when we get to court, that because of this Supreme Court dictum about when copyright is and isn't effective, that we'll have a very good argument. And we're able to do it because both of our clients are facing criminal liability for an action that they're that they can show that they are about to undertake. And so those are the rules to get standing in court. And you can, under those terms, you can ask the court to adjudicate whether or not the law that puts you at criminal risk passes constitutional muster. And so we're currently fighting over standing. The government introduced a motion to dismiss. We're waiting for the judge to rule. But we think that when we get to the actual substance, that we'll have ground to stand on. And the interesting thing is that America said to Canada, hey, we're going to jump off this bridge. We think you should do it too, right? So Canada passed Bill C-11. Well, what if America gets to the edge of the bridge and stops? Is Canada going to jump, right? If the Americans are manufacturing circumvention tools that allow Americans to fix their stuff, that allow American tractors to be independently serviced, that allow, you know, Americans to start alternative app stores for Apple phones and whatever, are Canadians going to continue to keep C-11 on the books, or are they going to turn around and say, oh, well, I guess if you're not going to go for this, we're not going to go for this. That's where we think like the future is going to be. That's how we think we're going to unwind it around the world. You know, suicide pacts are supposed to be mutual.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you think the ideals of the Enlightenment might be under threat in the fortress of science itself? So there was a time when the only thing you submit to adversarial peer review would be a paper.
Right.
Now a scientific conclusion can rest on data, the code that was used to analyze that data. And I don't think we have kind of the same sort of social norm that you must, you know, make your data available, you must make your code available. How are we doing on that front?
Well, I mean, you would know better than I would, because I'm not a working scientist. I mean, I do know that in the open access movement, publishing your data is considered a best practice. And certainly, like, the reproducibility crisis in machine learning seems to arise out of the fragmentation of data. You know, machine learning is one of the rare applications where people actually have to wait an appreciable period before they get a result out of their computer. I guess you folks probably work in a domain like that, or at least some of you do too as well. But I think a lot of us work in domains where we change a cell in a spreadsheet and then all of the conclusions update so quickly we don't even notice a lag. Whereas machine learning, it's the kind of thing where you kind of go away and you come back and you go away and you come back. And people reach into the machine and tune the parameters based on interim results, and they lose control of the recipe. And no one can reproduce anyone's results in machine learning. And there's a publication bias in machine learning for surprising performance improvements as opposed to well-documented procedures. And so, you know, this is a kind of like 1-2 punch where nobody keeps track of what they're doing. And we don't care whether you keep track of what you're doing if you want to get published. And so we have this crazy problem. Now, in addition, machine learning has a lurking reproducibility crisis because the training data in a lot of domains is super sensitive. And because the like major failure mode of machine learning is just sample bias, right? Like that is like the thing that everybody screws up in every kind of science is sampling bias. Without being able to see the underlying data, it's really hard to know whether or not you had an adequate data set when you concluded that, you know, left-handed people are evil and should be locked up, right? Like you need to know how the sampling was done. And if the way you did the sampling was by looking at sensitive psychiatric records or incarceration records or whatever, it's really hard to produce the kind of data that you would want if you were being sentenced to prison or committed involuntarily to a psychiatric facility, that you would want to be able to scrutinize to make sure that the algorithm was doing its thing correctly. And I think that we're going to see an increasing reliance on machine learning in those super sensitive domains, in part because those are domains that are already well understood to be subject to bias, and that human judgment really struggles to be neutral in and to not fall prey to kind of cognitive traps in. So we're going to want to use machines a lot to kind of fix that. And those may be the domains that we can't have enough scrutiny on to ever trust. And then that's, I don't know how we're going to resolve that. That's going to be really bad. It's going to be a big, bad, terrible policy fight. I mean, we're already seeing the like leading edge of it in fights about automated sentencing and automated parole recommendations, and automated policing, you know, predictive policing. And again, it's just like, it's all just GIGO, right? It's all just bad sampling. Like when domestic violence, for example, is underreported in detached houses versus semi-detached houses or apartment buildings, because the primary reporters of domestic violence are neighbors who hear it through a wall, right? So if you just use police reports to predict domestic violence, you end up under-protecting people who live in detached homes and over-policing people who live in apartment buildings, right? And like, you can only correct that if you can really scrutinize the data, but you can understand why data about domestic violence would be something that would be hard to make available. And like all the intermediate solutions that I've heard are like, well, maybe the state that's relying on predictive policing algorithms could invite experts. Like I was just at MIT and talking with this about this with them. I have a research fellowship with the Media Lab. And so I was talking with some people there who do this kind of predictive policing work. And they said, well, maybe the Secretary of State of Massachusetts could just nominate us to audit all the stuff. It's like, so we're going to go from a system in which adversarial peer review means that anyone can look at your stuff and decide whether it's good, to a star chamber nominated by the person who wants to buy the thing, gets to decide whether or not it's fit for purpose. Don't you anticipate that like this could be a problem down the line? You know, and I don't know how we resolve that. I mean, my presumption is that at least in domains where you're not putting people at risk, we should have the data in the public domain. We should have the negative results in the public domain. I think that like the lack of negative results is another crisis in scientific publishing. If only because there's a lot of grant money being spent reproducing things that didn't work last time because no one wanted to publish the result that said, I tried it and it didn't work, you know?
Okay, well,
So
we have snacks down in the bistro.
Excellent.
People can ask the speaker more questions.
Okay.
Let's thank Corey one more time.
Thank you very much.